You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Kathy Moon. I am the SK Korea Foundation Chair of Korea Studies at Brookings, and I am part of the Center for East Asia Policy Studies. I'm really happy that we have this opportunity to have Ambassador Donald Gregg back with us in Washington. I think if he stays any longer, you might not have free time at all or rest time. People will be coming to you to shake hands all the time. But we're very lucky that he's here. We're starting a little bit late because people are making their way through different meetings and lunch gatherings, but we do have a full house reservation from what we know. At any rate, I call this the Brookings Kathy as Oprah event. We want to make this a little bit less formal and give Ambassador Gregg the chance to tell his stories, because I think they're rich with information, perspective, experience, insight, and I think it's the right medium, a conversation, because what he is doing is working on people-to-people, human-to-human relations, and where conversation and sincere interaction are critical to the projects that he leads. Let me just ask you, please, to turn off your cell phones, dumb phones, smartphones, whatever you have, or at least to put them on vibrate, just so that we don't get interrupted. And what we're going to do is have an exchange, a conversation between Ambassador Gregg and me. We have been emailing and talking for a while now about his work and our views on U.S. Korea's U.S. North Korea policy, what's going on in North Korea, what's not going on in North Korea, what's not going on in the U.S. regarding North Korea. And through all that, we decided on a set of questions together that we would pose, and he would give us, you know, his feedback. And then we'll open up to the audience for Q&A as usual. So we're very happy you made this time, and we will proceed. I had hoped for comfy chairs and a microphone where we can walk around, but, you know, it's not the day for it. We have multiple events going on. I don't know how to introduce Ambassador Donald Gregg, because it's very cliché to say he's a man who needs no introduction, but I think that's definitely the case in this room and in this building. He's a friend of Brookings. He is well-known in Washington in many, many circles. As all of you know, he served as the U.S. ambassador to South Korea. He has served as the president of the Korea Society in New York City. He has served as CIA chief of station in South Korea way back, and has also served in Burma or Myanmar, numerous places, too numerous to examine in great detail, and I'd rather have us spend the time on our current conversation than your past exploits. So you have his bio, so please read them at your leisure, and we'll just get going. So, Ambassador Gregg, welcome to Brookings. Welcome back to Washington. I heard you had a fantastic, successful book launch. He is the author of Pot Shards. And why don't you tell us a little bit about your book, and then we'll make that the intro to the questions.
Thank you, Art. It's good to be here. John Merrill would get me down here occasionally for highly classified discussions, but this is the first public utterance I've made in Washington for about 10 years. What brought me here was the launching of this book, which took place last night, and it's called Pot Shards, Fragments of a Life Lived in CIA, the White House, and the Two Koreas. And I love the title. A lot of people, I ran into somebody yesterday who thought, well, why are you writing about Pol Pot in Cambodia? I won't tell you who that was. And also, I'm not writing about marijuana. But what I am writing about is fragments of memory sort of survive the way fragments of pottery do. And you don't know why certain things survive and certain things don't. And so I wrote about what I remembered, and I wrote about what really was important to me. And it's come through. I'm very happy with it. I was a philosophy major in college, and the death of my father when I was 16 was a very shattering thing for me. It sort of knocked off my religious beliefs, but I picked up some thoughts in philosophy that I carried with me into CIA. Probably the chief one is the man does not have a nature. He has a history for which he is responsible. I teach a course at Williams on intelligence work. I don't try to recruit anybody into CIA, but I try to get them to think like intelligence officers no matter what job they pursue. So I'm very glad to have gotten this off my chest. I'm now chairman of the Pacific Century Institute in Los Angeles, and my major focus there is continuing to work on laying a foundation for eventually developing a policy and a relationship with North Korea. So we'll get into that further. Thank you.
The PCI, Pacific Century Institute, does quite a lot of work, various types of work, especially related to North Korea, humanitarian issues, educational issues. So we do have their most recent newsletter that we did make copies of available to you out in the registration area. So I hope you'll pick one up if you haven't already. There's one thing that I do want to say about Ambassador Gregg that is never written in any of your official bios, which is that something I respect tremendously in human beings, and we just at lunch talked about Eleanor Roosevelt, and she fits into that category, is the capacity to grow and to learn no matter what age, what station in life you are, and the capacity and the willingness and the desire to transform oneself into a better human being. And I have deep respect for you, Ambassador Gregg, in that capacity because you have, as you talk about often, this incredible curiosity about life and the world and the willingness to use the information and insights to make yourself into a more thinking, more open-minded, and more caring human being. The second thing that does not appear on your profiles ever is that you have a wickedly good sense of humor. And for those of you who haven't experienced it, it's a real loss, let me tell you. I have been in some situations after conferences where I'm just holding my stomach and trying to breathe because he's telling good jokes and can do a really fun Japanese accent. He speaks Japanese fluently, but can tell jokes in Japanese accent very well, too. So I will not forget those moments. On the more serious side, in our conversations, I learned that Ambassador Gregg visited North Korea 6 times since 2002. And, you know, a lot of people use how many times they visited North Korea as sort of their business card. And Ambassador Gregg is not that type. He takes these trips incredibly seriously and purposefully. And what's interesting is that he told me that he has reported after every trip, he has reported in detail to the White House and the State Department all the goings-on and issues and insights, observations, and that you said you never heard back from the White House or the State Department. So one question is, why do you keep going? It's not an easy place to travel in or to get to, and the people that you would like to get responses from, not only the North Koreans but Washingtonians, are not responding. Why do you go?
Wonderful question. I think my interest in going to North Korea was sparked very much by Kim Dae-jung. I had helped keep him alive on two occasions, and when he was inaugurated president, he said, you know, you've been working hard on the Korea Society to improve American relations with South Korea, but you haven't done anything with North Korea. So I want you to plank the Korea Society flag in North Korea. So that's really what got me started. And I had started to build some relationships with North Korea and was at the dinner in Washington, or the lunch in Washington for Joe Myung-rok, given by Vice President Gore late in the Clinton administration, where he invited Bill Clinton to go to Pyongyang, and Clinton sent Madeleine Albright to check it out. And then the term came to an end, and in came George W. Bush. And the Axis of Evil pronouncement, which ranks among the most stupid remarks I've ever heard a president say, and I've heard a number, that killed everything with North Korea. And the North Koreans sort of reached out to me and said, you know, can we get something started? And one or two attempts were made. Nothing came of it. And so I decided to write a letter to Kim Jong-il. And I wrote it and told Fred Carrier about it. He was the only one I told. And I took it down to the North Korean embassy in New York, and a guy named Lee Gun was there. A lot of you know him. And he read it, and he said, how dare you write a letter like this to my leader? Who do you think you are? Very Korean response. And so I said, well, you know who I am. You dropped leaflets denouncing me when I was ambassador to South Korea. And I said, I'm writing this letter because there are things we really need to talk about. And he said, how do you know what we need to talk about? And I said, well, I've talked to George Tolaroya, who's talked to Kim Jong-il, who says that's what Kim Jong-il wants to talk about. And I've talked with Madeleine Albright, and I've talked with Kim Dae-jung. And so I said, I think we need to talk about how to avoid having a war. So he said, okay, that's a good answer. I'll send your letter. And so they sent the letter, and shortly thereafter I was invited to go. And so I then decided to tell the State Department. Now, I teach a course at Williams, and dealing with the government is always one of the issues. And so I say to them, what if I had gone to the State Department and said, hey, would you mind if I wrote a letter to Kim Jong-il? I think I would have been told in no uncertain terms not to do it. So I wasn't at all sure how they would feel when I told them that I'd written a letter and had been invited. They were very pleased, and I was relieved. And they sent a fine young Korean-speaking Foreign Service officer with me. The first question I was asked by Kim Gae-gwan was, why is George W. Bush so different from his father? I said, well, we're a big country, and the father was raised in New England. The son was born in Texas, and that makes a big difference. And so it sort of went from there. I suggested that they return the Pueblo, and they were about to do that when we accused them of a second track toward nuclear weapons, and things went very much awry. I went back to North Korea a second time and was given a written offer from Kim Jong-il to start dialogue with the United States. I got into the White House, to the National Security Office of Condi Rice's deputy. I'd worked there for 10 years. I was in and out in 20 minutes. He read the message, said, no, we won't talk to them. That would be rewarding bad behavior. And so that was sort of the response I have had from the government all along. So why do I keep going? It's imperative eventually that we have a relationship with North Korea. I totally reject the idea that they're going to collapse, and it's counterproductive for us to keep pushing in the hope of a collapse, which if it took place would be a disaster. So what we need to do is help draw them out of isolation so that they can eventually establish a decent relationship with the outside world. And that's moving slowly, but we are undertaking things which I think will lay a foundation so that when the decision comes to start talking and building a relationship, there will be people there who have relations with the outside world. There will be organizations with which there is a certain degree of trust, and there will be something to build upon. The North Koreans in February said, Obama has too much on his plate. He's not going to talk to us as long as he's president. We understand that. the sky's the limit for us with Kim Jong-un. That's an exact quote from the vice foreign minister. So we will just prepare and work and become stronger, and we'll talk to the next president. And so in this period of the next 2 years, I'm going to do all I can to continue to build that foundation.
You mentioned Kim Jong-un right now. So you have dealt with the father. You know a lot about the grandfather, obviously, and you studied him in depth, I'm sure. And now we're dealing with the grandson. When you say that it was conveyed to you from Kim Jong-un that the sky is the limit when the U.S. is ready, do you find that credible? How do you view his leadership in North Korea? Is it intact? Will it stay intact? For what time? Where is he going?
I had long been interested in him. I knew that he was being educated in Switzerland. I did all I could to find out as much as I could about that. I did not find out very much. But he arrived in North Korea. His father was still alive. And I felt that we had an opportunity to get to know him. So I wrote the vice president, whom I knew. I testified before him, his committee, two or three times. Keith, you probably remember at least one of those. And I suggested to Biden that we, the vice president, that we invite Kim Jong-un to the United States for an orientation tour. I said, we don't know very much about him. He doesn't know very much about us. And that would be a real opportunity to get to know him, and he's going to be around for 30 years. And I added the invitation might not be accepted, but the fact that it was offered would make a real impact. Well, it was turned down. I worked in the vice president's office for 6 years, and I was a master at turning down letters from people who suggested things that we weren't able to undertake, and I got a beautiful copy from Vice President Biden. And so later I said, what was the real reason? And the real reason was if they did that, the Republicans would have just tried to laugh them out of town. So we didn't do it. But I have felt from the get-go that he was in for the long run. The hardest pill I have had to swallow was the killing of his uncle. But that's the way things often work in a totalitarian society. There was some corruption involved in the part of the uncle, and I guess those around him felt that that was the best way to deal with it. Terribly unfortunate, but that's the way it has been. But he is interested in economic development. In the last trip I made, we got six questions from the North Koreans devoted to the kind of thing they hope to do economically, and they all are pointed toward the development of an economy that will interact with all of the neighbors. There's nothing about totalitarianism or Chuche or any of that. It's about how do we become accessible to foreign investment and foreign cooperation. And so I think he's there in the long run. I'm walking with a cane, and getting to Pyongyang via Beijing is not an easy trip. And I said to Ri Yong-ho, I said, there's no other leader I'd make this long trip for, but he's going to be around long after everybody else who's in power is gone, so I think it's worth reaching out to him because we need to get to know him better. We need to support what he's trying to do because he's taking North Korea in different directions, and a collapse, I think, would open up all kinds of possibilities, none of which would work to our benefit.
Thank you. It's a lot to chew on, especially for Washington audience who's not used to hearing about, in a sincere way that you've spoken about, Kim Jong-un's potential vision of economic development and reform in North Korea. But in the exchanges I've had, these are some of the issues that have been raised. North Koreans want to learn about international treaties on investments. They want to learn about business law, international business law. Also issues, principles of land lease contract, building an equipment lease contract. These are very, very concrete examples of some of the ideas and training and skills development that they seem to be interested in. And they also very much want to know about lessons learned from other places with SEZs. What works, what doesn't work, and why? So they're very specific, and when I see specific concrete things, I think that's better than abstract generalizations. But to what extent do you think that these can be carried out in North Korea, both in terms of the political will and human capacity?
The first thing that we did after coming back in February was to go to Jerry Cohen, who's a board member from PCI, who's a lawyer, a renowned scholar on China, who is trying to teach the Chinese what living up to international legal standards means, and it's not easy, and he really goes after them. And so we said, will you take on some North Koreans? And he said, absolutely. So four or five of them went down to Hong Kong. Spencer Kim sat in on it, and he said it was fascinating because the willingness to learn was absolutely there. Their ignorance was abysmal. And when we talked to them about what they want to do economically, they listed the kind of thing that Kathy has just laid out, but they said, we don't know how to do any of it. It was very impressive to me, the admission of their ignorance and their need for help. And, I mean, I just think it's so important to do that. James Min is here. He's been doing business in North Korea with DHL for many longer than perhaps any other American businessman. And you're a pioneer. And more people ought to follow what you're trying to do. The second thing we did was to have 20 young scientists from North Korean Ministry of Scientific Development meet in Dalian with six or seven faculty members from Syracuse. I've been working with Syracuse for over 10 years, and so we had these 20 people there for 3 weeks. And teaching them, improving their English. That was one of the key things that the North Koreans said. We know how important it is to send people into the world who really can speak English. And we know that they've got to do it much better than they do it now, but we don't have good English teachers. They're still frightened about sending people away for a full year. I have a year scholarship open for two economists at Williams. Full tuition, everything paid. They still don't dare do that. But they will send because they think they would learn and never come back. So they don't have enough that they haven't built up that much faith in themselves in terms of what they're doing. But they will send people for shorter periods. And the people who interacted with these 20 youngsters for 3 weeks said it was just a life-changing experience. Most of them had never been out of North Korea. They had no idea about what a modern city. Well, they're beginning to see it in Pyongyang, but they were fascinated to learn about the internet and the conversations and the questions that they were willing to ask, particularly after they'd been together for a week or so. And everybody there just felt it was a life-changing experience. So that's the kind of thing where going to try to continue to do. The next thing PCI would like to do is to have a meeting in Hawaii with some of the American Institute there, but at this point we can't get the promise of any visas being issued by the State Department. So we probably will be reduced to doing more things in China because it's closer, it's cheaper, but it's much less convenient. And it's not the same as getting North Koreans into the United States where they really can see how we live and what we're made of as people.
I think we should mention that the North Koreans have established a particular agency, the National Economic Development Commission, and you've spoken about that with me in the past. And that was established in October 2013. And, you know, if you think about these dates, it's interesting because October 2013 is also the time where there was so much internal turmoil. And yet there are these other tracks of bureaucratic political life that are being paved in a way. And this commission, the National Economic Development Commission, sometimes referred to as the State Economic Development Commission, is in charge of developing any and all special economic zones, I assume meaning the ones that exist as well as the ones that will be planned for the future, and that it wants to learn, quote, and open up to all the help it can get. And so there is a body that is directly connected to the cabinet under Kim Jong-un that's in charge of this. What I'm curious about is if let's talk a little bit more in depth about the actual people-to-people aspects of this. What kind of transformations have you witnessed in your dealings with North Koreans and also your colleagues having had experience in dealing with them from when you started these projects to now? And where do you see them going in terms of what will they do with the training, with the mind-opening experiences they have when they meet people from the U.S. or from other countries? What is your sense of their transformational capacity?
That's a tough question, but a very good question. I should add at this point that we are not the only people doing this. I think there's someone here from the German embassy, and I want to give credit to the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung, FES, which has been very much involved in this same kind of thing and sponsored largely a meeting in New York in March of 2012, which was probably the most substantive exchange I've had with high-level North Korean representatives. John Kerry was there. He was not yet Secretary of State. He said to them, we have no permanent enemies. There was talk of his going to North Korea very shortly, but then the Leap Day Agreement fell through, and so that stopped. I've gotten to know them quite well, and there was a sort of a lag one afternoon in the meetings, and I spoke up and said, you know, I'm dealing with people I've known for 10 years. We still have this terrible tendency to demonize people we neither like nor understand, and I used an evil word to describe what I meant by that, began with B. And it sort of stunned everybody. And Choi Sung-hui, who a lot of you know, spoke up and said, if you will give us a guarantee of security through a peace treaty, we will give up our nuclear weapons. Flat, unadulterated statement. Nobody had ever heard that before from a senior North Korean, and John Kerry was told about it, and he came later that afternoon, and I think there was a plan to send him to North Korea, which was undercut by the collapse of the Leap Day Agreement, which was very, very unfortunate. I find growing confidence. There are people who in 10 years are now in much more senior positions than they were before. The words we can use, the sense of work, the sense of cooperation is greater. I just feel there are an increasing number of people in North Korea who, thanks to work done by FES, the Canadians have done some things, the Australians have done some things. There are more and more people in North Korea ready to enter the outside world with a certain degree of sophistication and trust. It's all a sense of empathy. You can't prove it because they haven't had the opportunity, but the desire to do it and the competence to do it, I think, has grown over the 12 years I've been going there. An example of that, were you going to get into the Philharmonic?
Yeah, but go ahead.
Well, I was going to use that as an example. Is that all right?
Sure. Yeah, it's your show.
In 2008, there was a discussion about going New York Philharmonic going to Pyongyang. And it's funny because in 2004, the Philharmonic was going to South Korea, and there was concern about whether that was safe. And so I had to go over and talk to the New York Philharmonic saying it's okay to go to South Korea. And so in 2008, we got them to go to North Korea. And it was Lauren Mazel did a masterful performance. He learned to speak some Korean. He played arirang. And then most important, the next day there were master's classes. And both sides were blown away by it. The North Koreans had no idea that our musicians would do it, and our musicians had no idea that the North Koreans were as skilled as they are. And in February, when I was there, they took me to a concert of their state symphony orchestra, which they would love to send here. It's 100 people, and it would cost them, you know, but they had 3 different conductors, and it's a magnificent orchestra. So there was just one area where effort counts and endeavors pay, and a link has been forged, which I think can be built on in the future.
Well, doing a little bit more research after our numerous, you know, give and take, which was research enough, I found this article. It's in Korean and by Yonhap News. I know Yonhap News is here. This is really interesting that next month in the UK, both at Oxford, Cambridge, and then in London, there is a group of disabled North Koreans with disabilities, especially young people, children up to the age of 20, I believe, who are dancers, singers, etc. And they've been invited by the Brits to tour and to give concerts, performances. So they have several of these lined up toward the end of October. And then there is some hope that some arrangement can be worked out between the British government, the musical and dance training centers, and the North Korean government to enable some of these kids to be able to study in the UK. So I thought it's an interesting, not exactly a follow-up directly, but a continuation of this kind of cultural diplomacy. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the British do have diplomatic relations with Yes. North Korea, which makes a huge difference Yes. in enabling these kinds of activities. And also the North Korean government does allow North Koreans to stay in the UK for long periods of time, much longer than in the US. And I assume that has something to do with the normalization of relations as well as trust building, because they Absolutely. Have been able to get to know one another for a longer time on an official basis. And they even talk about human rights issues as agenda issues, whereas we can't actually do that officially. So there are some interesting developments here when we compare what's going on or not going on in the U.S. with what's going on in Europe in particular. Yeah. Going back to the Philharmonic, can you tell me a little bit, or tell us, I was particularly interested because I wrote an op-ed about this, and I dug it out. It's from 2009, but that to me what was so striking was the background stories, the untold stories of that program, that project, that huge project to take the New York Philharmonic to North Korea, that there was a Japanese European woman who Yep. was a major funder, right? The major funder. So a woman of Japanese descent who said she doesn't care about politics. She just loves music and wants it to be shared everywhere, especially in places where it can't be shared freely. And you had a lot of individuals who played very behind-the-scenes role who made it possible. Why do people do this? And what kind of organizational capacity is needed if we were to be able to institutionalize these kinds of exchanges in the long run?
I think it takes pioneers. I think it takes people who are interested in the results, not interested in accruing credit for what they have done. Spencer Kim, the founder of the Pacific Century Institute, was very much involved, a lubricant in terms of finance, and he worked with that woman. And he wasn't anxious to take credit. He just wanted this trip to take place. And that is, I think, very, very important. In another completely different capacity, the trip I took in February involved sort of peacekeeping in a one-on-one basis. I've known Pete McCloskey, former congressman, for about 15 years. McCloskey is a retired, was congressman for 16 years. Before that was a Marine. He was known as the Beowulf of the 5th Marines. He received the Navy Cross and the Silver Star. Paul Newman made a film about him called Leading from the Front and said he'd led more bayonet charges than anybody since the Civil War. And Pete heard I was going to North Korea, and he said, will you take me with you? I am haunted by what I did, and I would like to meet a North Korean soldier and compliment him for his bravery and tell him that we just must not let this kind of thing happen again. So this was sent to the North Koreans, and I think I knew the people up there well enough to do this, so they didn't think that I was some kind of a nutcase. And so they said, yeah, bring him. And so they had located a retired lieutenant general who was a docent in one of their new museum. And there's a picture of him in this book. He's a tiny little guy. And Pete is a great big Irishman. And so we met in the museum, and he didn't know what the hell was going on, because here was this big American saying, you know, I really want to make peace with you after all these years, and didn't really work. And I talked to the man and said, this man is very sincere. He'd love to meet you again. So Pete went back the next day, and they started talking, and he said, well, how many times were you wounded? And the man said, 3. And he said to Pete, how many times were you wounded? And Pete said, well, only 2. And then Pete said, well, how old were you? And he said, I was 17. And what was your weapon? He said, heavy machine gun. And then he volunteered. He said, I think I killed 400 of you. And Pete did not tell him how many he had killed, many of them in hand-to-hand combat, but he said, this must never happen again. And so they embraced and saluted and made peace with each other. And there was a very fine article about it in the New York, in the LA Times. And the North Koreans are, last time I met with them in New York 10 days ago, they said we would welcome a larger group of American veterans to come back and do the same thing that McCloskey did. And I got this message from McCloskey. He said, the healing therapy of that wonderful trip to Pyongyang has stayed with me. I haven't had one of those dreams of emptying a 30-round carbine magazine at full automatic into the upturned, terrified faces of a bunch of Korean 16-year-olds since I returned. So those are some of the costs of war that people carry with them, and this is, I think, a step in the right direction. Now, to cheer you up a little bit, McCloskey has a tremendous sense of humor. And he is a great admirer of George Herbert Walker Bush. And so they knew each other when they were in Congress. And so McCloskey, a couple of years ago, said, my wife and I are going down to Houston. We'd love to call on President and Mrs. Bush, the good Bush. And so I said, yeah, I can arrange that. So they went in and saw George and Barbara Bush, and he wrote me an email and said, we had a great hour together. And he said, I don't know what possessed me, but when I left, I had a button, one of those things you put on your refrigerator door. And I said, Mr. President, I think you'll enjoy this. And he pressed it into his hand, and Bush looked at it and howled with laughter. And what it said was, Jesus loves you. Everybody else thinks you're an asshole. And so, anyway, that's the kind of guy McCloskey is. So a couple of months ago, I was here in Washington, and Jim Baker was being given a dinner at ADST, so I hadn't seen him for years, and I went up to him, and we exchanged notes, and I said, by the way, and then I told him this story. And he sort of lowered his glasses and looked at them, and he said, Bush sent that button to me. So, you know, I'm a great believer in the strength of humor. And so McCloskey, he's tremendously humorous, but he was vulnerable to what he had done, and he's been cured by it, and he would like to lead another larger group back And the fact that the North Koreans are enthused about it, I think, is very meaningful.
That's a very interesting story in terms of North Koreans, in a way, informally inviting a delegation of American veterans. You bring up the issue of war and the human costs and the legacy of those human costs that haunt people. What struck me on my trip there two summers ago was I was ready for all of the militarized placards and everything else, posters, you know, that just cover up every wall and every, you know, surface in the public. But I was just amazed and truly awed in the sense of awestruck, not knowing what to do and how to think about the hyper-militarization of the society, the absolute contortion and distortion of history. And in some ways I started thinking about, you know, we talk a lot about human rights as something that happens to one's body and one's mind. But, you know, I thought about history and the distortion of it and the everyday living experience of it as a distorted history, the official history, not the individual ones, as one of the greatest human rights violations in a sense, because on a collective level, because people aren't even aware of it many times. And I've always been wondering since then, you know, people talk about reconciliation, unification between the two Koreas, and I think, what do we do with history? How do we reconcile peoples with histories that are so divergent, is putting it mildly, and with a North Korean version in particular that is so hyper-militarized and villainized? You talk about the dangers of vilifying the other, but, you know, obviously this happens both ways, North Koreans to the U.S. as well as U.S. to North Koreans. But do you have any thoughts, given your interactions on the human level, of how we might be able to deal with this hyper-militarized, you know, this? They still live in a state of war, literally, right? And in a mindset of war. So they have all of these projects and plans and aspirations, but how do these aspirations for a new North Korea, a more sustainable, livable, hopefully livable North Korea, mesh with or square with, if at all, with this hyper-militarized war state?
Very good question. A couple of comments. Ri Yong-ho, the vice foreign minister, said on our meeting, you know, the B-29 is still in our DNA, because it was the B-29 that just absolutely flattened Pyongyang, bombing, napalm, all of that. And when you fly B-52s at us with nuclear weapons, it really gets us riot. And so I feel, when I was ambassador, one of the things I did was to stop for 1 year the holding of the Team Spirit training exercise, which gets the North Koreans just on a hyper alert, because it's a memory of that. And then Dick Cheney, without telling the embassy or the State Department, put Team Spirit back in place, and it undid virtually everything that had been accomplished. So it is there. And it's not going to go away easily. I mean, you won't like this, but I think it's something that should be raised. Think of our own country. Think of the issue of slavery, which still divides our country. 150 years after Gettysburg, what has arisen in our hearts and mind with Obama as president is a reminder of how difficult it is to deal with the kind of differentiation which the North Koreans are doing. So it isn't going to come quickly, and it isn't going to come easily. I think one of the quickest ways to do it would be to have sufficient economic development in North Korea so that when the army is disbanded, there is a place for them to go to work. And when we crazily disbanded the Iraqi army and left them with nothing but their guns and their discontent, you had hell to pay. And so we've got to think ahead as to how that can be avoided. And so that's why these economic developments are so important. John DeLury is a man who used to be at the Asia Society. He's now teaching at Yonsei, and he's written a very good book on China called Wealth and Power. And I asked him about this very issue, Kathy, and this is what he said. Geostrategic insecurity in North Korea is the main reason for slow economic reform and opening up. They don't have a need for security. We keep threatening them with exercises, and so their own sense of the need for security is reinforced. He said the Chinese, with whom he deals all the time, says North Korea reminds them of China in 1970, waiting for a security guarantee such as that which they got from Nixon, and which caused them then to open up. But he said the cycle of hostility is self-sustaining, because when we do things in a hostile fashion, the hawks in North Korea, and they are there, they respond. And so this cycle of hostility, which delays the start of an unraveling of these two different sets of history, is further delayed.
Okay. Lot to chew on here. I think I'll make this the last question so you can have some time with the audience and continue the discussion. But based on your many years both in government as well as in these Track 2 processes, what kind of advice would you give both to NGOs, Track 2 types of people who want to be pursuing whatever type of work on a people-to-people level? And what kind of advice would you give to U.S. policymakers regarding their agendas? So whether it's NGOs or whether it's the government, the policy priorities, their organizational agendas, strategy for getting done what they want to get done, what to expect when dealing with North Koreans, both at the governmental and non-governmental level, and some of the some of the communication processes or particularities to expect and how to overcome them?
An awful lot to chew on there. I get very discouraged about the bureaucratic mentality. I think it is very difficult for bureaucrats to change their position or to say, I was wrong. And I think everybody has a vested interest in the value of, what is it, strategic patience. They keep finding new ways of saying, yes, it works, and we have to be patient, and we have to continue it. I think they avoid talking with me. They occasionally will reach out to people with whom I work, and they haven't had a new idea about North Korea for a decade. I was asked by the Obama administration, the campaign, before he was elected, to speak to a bunch of Koreans in New York. And my Republican opponent was head of the Republican Party in New York State. And we were talking about Korea, and I knew a hell of a lot more about it than he did, and so I think I was fairly successful, and I thought, well, I may be hearing more from Obama. The man he had in charge of those affairs knew nothing about Korea, and I could tell that from the questions he asked and the things he didn't know. Well, he stayed in place. He was a China specialist. And I think it was really through that channel that they picked up the line from the Bush administration, and that is, we've bought that cow two or three times. Talking for the sake of talk is not worth it. Talking to them is rewarding bad behavior. And I don't think you're going to get any of these people to change their minds. And I think the North Koreans have reached that position. They have said, Obama isn't going to talk to us. We need a new president and a new team. And I don't have any quarrel with that. As far as the NGOs are concerned, I think this is a terribly important time to keep laying the foundation for a change that is going to come. And don't get discouraged at this point, because you just don't have any real support from the bureaucracy here in Washington. It's all the more important that we continue to reach out and lay a foundation upon which a better relationship can be built. So I find great receptivity to that. I'm really encouraged by what is happening in places like Germany and Australia and England, and as more and more countries see this. In Pyongyang in February, we had fascinating conversations with the Swedish ambassador who takes care of our interests there, and he is very well plugged in, and he is all for this kind of thing that we are doing. So I have no answer as to what to do about people in Washington, but I have a desire for continued energy and patience in terms of the NGOs, and I have great confidence that they'll respond.
Thank you very much. If you recall, I was the moderator of that presidential surrogate presidential debate that you had on foreign policy, U.S. policy toward the Koreas in New York, right? And you were speaking for the Obama campaign, and Mr. Cox was speaking for the...
Oh, I had forgotten that was...
Yeah, that was... That
did
was,
I clean his clock?
I would say, given that I moderated, I would say you're the victor.
Thank you.
You definitely, I would say, you know, I won't say obliterated him. You're too gracious for that, but... it was definitely a good debate, and you definitely won. But what was interesting is the number of Korean Americans who showed up for that event. And I know that that grew quite well, and they have been growing. And so, and that's another group in the U.S. that has a lot invested in what goes on in on the peninsula for both personal, his family, historical, as well as political reasons. But it was an incredibly useful, informative, and it was an exchange that was very helpful. And I too thought you were going to be asked to do more for the Obama administration, but instead you're now here in Brookings. And once you come to Brookings, you do get heard. You will be heard. So who knows? You may be getting a phone call from the White House tomorrow.
I won't hold my breath. But thank you.
At any rate, there's a lot I could ask of Ambassador Gregg, but I won't take up more time. And I'll open the floor to you all so that you can ask him your own questions and share with him your comments. I'll just continue as moderator, and we'll go to Sam Yoon and then to Scott. Just please tell us who you are, where you're from.
Sam Yoon, president of the Council of Korean of the Council of Korean Americans. We're a new organization and network of Korean American leaders. I really appreciate your talk and your lifetime of service. I also have like a dozen questions. I'm going to limit myself to one. I want to talk about public opinion, because what you're telling us is that you've kind of given up on U.S. policy and government responsiveness to new ideas. Well, you know, if we believe in our democracy, they should be responsive to, you know, the public opinion. But even that, I can see, is quite a challenge. I believe Secretary Kerry today is, or soon will be addressing the UN, and his job is obviously to amplify the human rights report that came out and to draw attention to the abuse. So in this kind of public conversation about North Korea, where it seems the human rights question is dominant, and it's something that no one in this room would say is not relevant, I wonder the dynamic, because we're talking about people and the people and just the almost the emotional response that people have to words and concepts and messages. To the extent that folks are going to be, including Secretary of State, our government, amplifying the issue of human rights, how does that what is the relationship between the conversation we're having now about the need to engage, the need to open up? Because if basically, to me, it comes down to human nature. It's one guy over here saying, you're bad, you know, you're bad. And the other person says, I want to talk to you. So can those two conversations happen in the same voice? Can we even, the person who says you're bad and the other person says, I want to talk to you, can they even have a dialogue? Should they have a dialogue? So the idea of having two tracks, I think, historically seems to be something we've done only because maybe the two tracks really haven't talked to each other. Is there a need for that, or is this just something where we do need a multifaceted kind of, even if it's contradictory sometimes, kind of a, you know, engagement with North Korea?
I worked in the White House for 10 years, And the White House has limited ability to deal with multifaceted crises. I saw the Carter administration paralyzed by the Iran hostages. I saw the Reagan administration paralyzed by Iran-Contra. And the president has a, we were saying at lunch, has a Rubik's Cube of foreign policy issues. Secretary Kerry, I think, is doing a magnificent job in trying to make progress with the Arabs and the Israelis, with Putin and Ukraine, and now with ISIS. And there is zero political benefit to reaching out to North Korea. Zero. And so for us to start petitioning the embattled White House at this point, saying, hey, you know, you've got to reach out to North Korea, you would get nowhere, and you would just annoy people saying, for heaven's sake, don't bother us at this point. I think the North Koreans have reached that analysis. I think it's realistic. I think there's going to be no change on Obama's thinking on North Korea unless something totally unexpected. I mean, if they suddenly released all three of the people and said, we're shutting off Yongbyon, that might do it. I don't think they're going to do that. So I think for the next two-plus years, the best thing we can do is to continue to cultivate relations with the North. I dealt with Mr. Kirk. Is he the one who wrote the human rights report?
Kirby.
Right. I spoke with him when he presented his report to the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and I said, your report is a call to action, not to try to overthrow North Korea, but to get them to face up to the realities of what they've done and to try to change. And he very much agreed with that. And he indicated, and I know it's hard to judge, but he said he thought things had improved somewhat under Kim Jong-un, the conditions and the number of people involved. And I think that's about the best we can do. And I know Kerry fairly well. I admire him, but I think to come at him with another controversial thing at this point would just be counterproductive in every way.
Not to mention North Koreans not being able to play multitasking games too well. Scott, you had your...
Yeah, Scott Snyder, Council on Foreign Relations. First, I just want to thank you, Don, for your lifetime of passion for the U.S. relationship with both Koreas. I'm sure I'm looking forward to reading your book. The question that I want to ask is your analysis of the inter-Korean relationship at this stage, and maybe particularly in historical perspective, since you mentioned Kim Dae-jung and his engagement. And you know, what do you think the prospects are at this stage with Park Geun-hye? And then also, how do you see the relationship between the inter-Korean relationship and prospects for U.S.-North Korean engagement, even at the non-governmental level?
As one would expect from you, a very tough, good question. Park Geun-hye, what I've said about President Park is that, in my opinion, Korea has had three great presidents. Her father, for his economic development. No Tae-woo, for his diplomacy and for the progress he made with North Korea, and Kim Dae-jung. I said I think she has the ability to become the fourth really great president only if she reaches out to North Korea in a convincing way, and she has not done it. And I think she's a very disappointing. She's very disappointing to me. I knew her father. I had met her when she was a little girl. She went to Sogang University, which gave me an honorary degree, so we have that in common. I saw her at the opening game of the World Cup in 2002, and she had been to North Korea the year before and had met with Kim Jong-il. And I said, I want to compliment you for doing that. That was magnificent, given the fact of who killed your mother and who tried to kill your father two or three times. And she said, I'll never forget it. We must look to the future with hope, not to the past with bitterness. And I was hoping that that would be the motto of her presidency. It has not been. She has brought some of the hardliners from her father's time forward. The intelligence reminds me of KCIA at its worst under Lee Hurak. I'm extremely disappointed in what she's done. And I don't really expect much from her. It makes it difficult, even more difficult for people like me who think we ought to talk, because there are some Americans say, oh, well, yeah, we would, but the South Koreans don't want us to. It's kind of a Rubik's Cube. Now, I'll be very interested to meet the mayor of Seoul tomorrow and to see, what he has on his mind. But it's also a generational problem. One of my closest Korean friends, a woman who was head of the Catholic Women's Association in Seoul, I mean, she thinks Kim Dae-jung is a secret communist. I mean, she just couldn't believe that. She thought it was a mistake that I helped keep him alive. And she still feels that way. And there are, I think, a lot of Koreans who feel that way. Now, that has to pass. And time will take care of that. So, I think that there is a new study. Somebody is doing proportionate recommendation.
Or tailored engagement.
Tailored engagement.
Shin Kyu-wook, he's coming next week.
Monday. I mean, I think that sounds like...
right here.
Good. Long may he wave, because I think that kind of thing is extremely important to do. I say to young South Koreans and young Korean Americans who are wondering what are you going to do, I say get really expert in Korean, because there's going to be a lifetime of careers in helping bring North Korea back into the family of nations. There are going to be all kinds of teaching jobs opening up in North Korea that would be absolutely fascinating. But it's going to come slowly, and I hope very much that the next president in South Korea will be much more active in reaching out to the North. Yeah.
And Roberta?
Roberta Cohen. I'm with Brookings Institution and also co-chair the Committee for Human Rights.
Would you speak up, because I think we're getting some of this recorded. So.
Oh, okay. Roberta Cohen. I'm a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings and also co-chair the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. I wanted you to go back to some of what you were talking about, meeting North Koreans who are interested in learning more about business and being accessible, foreign investment, et cetera. Do you build into these dialogues other issues? For example, I don't imagine you can just technically discuss business. There is the question of information, internet, freedom of information. There's the question of transparency of transactions. There's the whole question having to do with just communication and a sense of I don't want to say human rights, but courts, rule of law. Many of these issues, and they are human rights issues actually, are the foundation for that kind of business transactions that will be successful. How do you address this in the work you're doing?
Did you all hear that? I mean, how do you address these issues of the law, of human rights, of transparency, and so forth? It's very tough. I've spent enough time in the South to know how difficult it is to get at some of those issues in Mississippi, the whole issue of how our local police handle people. We've had examples of that in Ferguson. So we are far from perfect, and it's very difficult to get people who are indoctrinated in a system as the North Koreans have been to get them to change. I think the only way to get that change to come is to get them to see that it is in their interest to change. They won't do it because they think they ought to. They will not do it. You can explain to them why we think certain ways are necessary, certain ways are beneficial, and then they have to come to their agreement that it is. But I think in a hortatory, finger-wagging basis, you don't really get very far with anybody in lecturing them on those issues.
What I actually meant was, how would business and how would foreign investment, how would this work effectively in their interest,
yeah,
without these other issues being a foundation? That is what I mean. I'm not talking about.
Okay. Well, let me ask James, how do you, you've been doing business there. I mean, how do you, you give an answer to her question. I mean, I'm sure you ran into all kinds of problems of corruptions, of non-transparency, of broken promises. How did you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, Roberta, and I think because this is on the record, I can't really divulge too much, but business does have an impact in those areas. People are shocked when they hear that, yeah, we can email our personnel in Pyongyang when we need to track a shipment, and there's communication. And there's greater internet access available. And some of the meetings we've had, we've shown them Google Maps and Google Satellite. And so those things are entering the minds of North Koreans, especially from the business perspective.
Just to supplement a bit, I think, Ambassador Gregg, you had already mentioned that one of the main projects that PCI, Pacific Century Institute, conducts is international business law training and contract law, as well as international norms about conducting commerce, trade, et cetera. And Jerome Combe, Jerry Cohen, is, for those of you who don't know, one of the longstanding, very well-regarded Chinese law or legal systems professors in the world, and very much committed to issues of human rights as well as all sorts of other legal issues. And so the fact that he has stepped in and thinks it's worth his time, to me, says a lot. Just that he is willing to invest his precious time and energy. And he's also not exactly a spring chicken, so that's a lot of work for him to be traveling to Asia periodically to be doing this. And he has made great progress dealing with Chinese, so he knows of what he speaks. I think what's also important is that from some of the exchanges you and I have had, that the North Koreans themselves want to learn about law. And perhaps that's the most important thing, because we can offer curriculum that touches law, but if people don't want to learn, but the fact that they are asking for it says something. And I think what's interesting in the communications is also from one of your colleagues at PCI that I had privilege to look in on, was the insights of this PCI, or I guess one of the people who had delegation members who went to the Dalian group, that the folks from, and many of these people were from the North Korean government, or at least seconded to the delegation, they were fascinated to have access to the internet in Hong Kong, and that was one of the highlights for them. And they knew about it, but some knew more than others. Some had had access, some had not. And the fact that they could not have full access because of Chinese law was a bit of a constraint, but nevertheless, they were able to access it. Also to find friends of theirs in different parts of Asia just by emailing, they found fascinating. And so the sense of connectedness that these folks from North Korea were able to have, even for a relatively short period of time, it seemed to me from the travel reports, left a very, serious imprint on them. So who knows in terms of what, you know, kind of cravings they'll have, you know, in the future. And let's move toward this side of the room. We'll go Nick and Andrew and anyone here I'll take next.
Thank you. Nicholas Hamasevich from the Korea Economic Institute. Because government-to-government relations are so limited and poor, often when we have an opportunity for these people-to-people connections, there seems to be hope that that will lead to better government-to-government connections. And so how should we or governments think about how to properly use the opportunities of these people-to-people connections, whether they're Incheon games or other type of opportunities, to use those better relations or that opportunity to create better government-to-government contacts and relations?
I think it depends on who you choose to be in those positions. There are certain people who are open to new ideas, and there are certain people who are not, many people who are not. Now you have Sung Kim coming into a senior position. He's been in South Korea as ambassador. I think now is the time to go to him when he is new in the job, when he is stacking up his priorities and his time. He isn't particularly locked into everything else that's been said and thought. And I think it's when somebody is new to a job that he is most open to new ideas. I think the old horses who've been in the same job for several years, I think it's very difficult to get them to really open up a new approach.
Can I just add to your question? What about the flip side? Because often North Koreans expect a lot from the NGOs or individuals they're dealing with who are non-governmental, that they actually can deliver something to the governments or from the governments.
We have found that the key to being successful is to not raise expectations artificially, not to promise something that we're not pretty sure we can deliver, because we have found that consistency and reliability and discretion are really the keys to trust with them. It's interesting because North Koreans know of my intelligence background, and so I have gone out of my way to never give them cause for concern. And they have accepted me as basically a career intelligence officer whom I think they've grown to trust. But I think if it came out that I had been working for CIA or if I had been carrying an official agenda with me, that would have wiped out everything that I was trying to do. I would say I would never speak critically of my own government, any more than I would expect them to speak critically of their government. But I just said, I will deal honestly with you. And when they gave me a secret message to take to the White House, I said, now I'm going to pass through Seoul. I said, do you want me not to say anything to the South Koreans? And they said, that's up to you. Now, that impressed me, that they didn't say, you know, oh, no, you mustn't say anything. They said, it's up to you. And a good point, but that's what I have to say.
Okay, great. Andrew.
Hi, Andrew Yeo, Catholic University. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the leadership at the top, Kim Jong-un, and how serious you think he is with some of these. You said that there is a request for more things like learning about business law or English. There's a National Economic Development Commission that's been established. North Korea's not – there are different voices within North Korea, but it's really the top that matters. So one question that I had for myself was, well, if there is an opening and there are these reforms, is it possible that Kim Jong-un, like a flip of a switch, could just stop this because he sees that his own leadership becomes threatened? And so I was wondering, again, how serious do you see Kim Jong-un right now in these reforms that you had suggested earlier.
ICBC, everybody who went on the, well, there were four of us who went in February, and we all sensed a great change of atmosphere in the 4 or 5 years since we've been there, that there was a willingness to tell us what they were planning and a willingness to say, we don't know how to do it. And there was not that kind of willingness under Kim Jong-il. So we sense that from everything we heard, that they have a young leader who is saying, look, we've got to do better than we have been doing. We won't, you know, we can't admit it publicly, but we need to learn how to relate to the world economically. Now find out how to do it. And it was just a different atmosphere, which I think, because it's such a hierarchical place, that I felt this was the trickle-down atmosphere from Kim Jong-un. And as I watch him going around talking to various people and the kind of people he makes himself open to, he's much more confident. I mean, what I've said to the North Koreans is this. I'm a consultant to ABC News. And so Diane Sawyer would love to go and interview Kim Jong-un. And so I said that to Ri Yong-ho, and he began to roll his eyes. And I said, okay, forget that. But, you know, you have got a leader who is like his grandfather in that he's very confident in meeting people. His father was not. And you have somebody who needs to stop sending smoke signals from a cave. And this is a phrase I used with Ri Yong-ho. I said, you need to get him out front and have him talk to the world about where he wants to take North Korea. And you haven't had anybody really do that. And so we don't have anything to really hang on. And I said, but you now have your, Kim Jong-il wouldn't do that. He wasn't that confident. I mean, Madeleine Albright and I had a long talk about that. I mean, she was very funny about that. She said, well, he and I are about the same height. We both wear high heels, and we both put mousse in our hair. But he also was, he wasn't very confident, but Kim Jong-un is. And I said, get him out front and start saying, this is what I'm trying to do. And he said, I get it. So I haven't seen any results of that, but that's what they ought to do. Because they've got a kid there, a young man who is capable of projecting really what he wants to do. That would be a new factor, and I think it would be tremendously beneficial.
Yes, Larry.
Ambassador Gregg, I'd like to ask you about the North Korean media. Everything that we see about North Korea tells us that the agitation and propaganda department of the Workers' Party has tremendous power and authority, and that North Korean leaders, certainly Kim Jong-il, paid great attention to what the media said, what the messages coming out of the propaganda arm were saying. Now, just this year, the highest level North Korean media organs have repeatedly described President Park as a prostitute. They called President Obama a monkey, a direct racial slur. I understand they've come out with something similar about Secretary Kerry now. Two or three years ago, they described Secretary Clinton as a grumpy, dumpy old schoolmarm type, something like that. Have you ever had a chance to talk to them about these kinds of personal attacks and slurs and get from them what they think they get out of it? Why do they engage in this kind of media strategy, if you will? What are their objectives? What do they think they gain from this?
I was very upset by that particular line, which happened after I got back from North Korea. I said, I have said, you're still doing things that are unworthy of you. And if I had a chance to talk with those same people, I would have said that about them. Now, the answer I get from that is that it's a stovepipe kind of organization and that these people are still very powerful and that they sort of answer to themselves. Now, if once Kim Jong-un is fully in charge, I think he will shut them down. And he needs to hear that. He absolutely needs to hear that from friends. And if and when I go back, I will make a point to raise that. But I hope that some of the other people who are going to him from the in the or doing to them are saying that kind of thing. But you never know. I mean, I sent a when I went into to when his father was there, I took movies because I knew he was a you know he loved movies. So I carefully selected three movies, and I heard that he enjoyed them all. One was The Patriot, which was the Revolutionary War. Another was Training Day, which is a police thing. And the best of all was Ronin, a great shoot 'em up with Robert De Niro, directed by a classmate of mine at Williams. And I got feedback saying, hey, he really liked them. Now, I sent this book, personally inscribed. Now, do I think he will see it? I have no idea. But it would be very interesting if I got some say, well, he thank you for the book, he enjoyed it, you know. But you don't get that kind of thing. I mean, the hierarchy... And I found that in dealing with the Soviets in all through the Cold War. You never knew how far up the truth was in getting to the ears of the leader, because there is a tremendous fear of taking bad news to the leader. When I was chief of station in Seoul, I told President Park's bodyguard that he needed a minister of bad news and to tell him the things he didn't want to hear. And we played golf. I played golf with him one time, President. And I spoke to him in Japanese. He was fluent. And he sort of looked at me, you know, with sort of hard-eyed things. Neither of us were very good golfers, and we both hit our ball into the rough. And he looked at me and he said, you know, Greg, if you didn't work so hard, you'd be a better golfer. So I said, I think I heard that they took my idea to him, that he needed a business, and he would make no answer to it. Because I don't think they want to hear bad news. And so that's the problem of getting what you just said to the ears of the person who can shut it down.
I think we'll take one last question.
Last questions are always very dangerous.
Well, hopefully nothing will be thrown at you, so I don't think you have to worry. Back there, yeah.
Hi. Thank you for speaking to us today. My name is Sabrina Tai from the Project 2049 Institute, and I just have Project 2049 Institute. We're based in Virginia, Asia Pacific think tank. My questions are, I actually have two questions, if you could just touch on.
Do one.
Just one, okay. In terms of engagement, I do agree that engagement is very, very important, even in a time like this when the administration is not able to do as much or chooses not to. Could you differentiate between if there is a strategy for smart engagement versus just any type of engagement? Do you think that all engagement is good, or is there like good engagement versus bad? So what is...
No, I don't think all engagement. I think you have to be very careful about that. But that kind of thinking usually goes on when there's a new administration moving in, or when there's a new relationship or a new direction being taken. But it's very important to lay those things out. And I think that there have been some examples of NGO stuff that hasn't been so good. I mean, I think... Those of the three guys that are in jail, I think all of them, it was really unfortunate that they did some things that they were very foolish in doing. When I went to North Korea with Pete McCloskey, he is very impetuous and he writes a lot of notes at night. And I was very careful every morning when we woke up in the morning to say, don't leave anything behind in your room. And so we were that, but it's a very good point, and I think that the kind of engagement is extremely important. If I could just end, if that is the last,
sure,
with a sort of a Korean anecdote. One of the reasons that I maintain such an interest in in dealing with Koreans. When I was ambassador, I'd been there about a month, and one morning, six young students from Busan broke into the embassy residence by climbing over the wall, and they tried to set fire to it. And the issue was beef exports. And so the Korean police eventually got there and carried them off. I called up Blue House and I said, you know, don't be too hard on them and so forth. So that was in October 1989. Three out of the six have personally apologized to me. Two of them are in the National Assembly. One of them came to see me in 2006 when I was staying there with a camera and formally apologized. And this winter, on a very snowy day, I got a call saying that this man was in New York and he wanted very much to see me. And so out he came with several people. He's now quite a prominent member of the National Assembly. And he came in and he had a picture of us shaking hands several years ago. And he said, I want to meet your wife. And so in my wife came and he got up and said, I want to apologize to you for what we did. And he wept. And it was so Korean. It was just, it was very moving to everybody. And we had a terrific talk and I think he's going to go far. And that is just, to me, a wonderful Korean story that, you know, he did this when he was 18 or 19, and now that he's 50, he's thinking back on it and wants to make amends. And that's, I love that story. It's very Korean because the Koreans are willing to say, hey, I'm sorry about that, and we're going in a new direction. And that's one of the reasons I so enjoy working with Koreans in either North or South. So thank you very much for your
attention. Thank you very much.